Hello and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the Commonwealth Club and your host for tonight. Our program tonight is The End of Hierarchy with Gary Hamel. And I am going to turn the program over now to Gillian Gray from the London Business School Alumni Association of the Bay Area, and she will introduce Gary. Please welcome Gillian.
Hello. When I was a student at London Business School, Gary Hamel was one of our favourite professors. He was always provocative and entertaining. His thinking challenged preconceptions about how companies won the competitive race. Gary's landmark books, which have been translated into more than 20 languages, include Competing for the Future, Leading the Revolution, and the Future of Management. His latest book, What Matters Now, was published in 2012. As a consultant and management educator, Gary has worked for companies as diverse as General Electric, Shell, and 3M. He speaks frequently at the world's most prestigious management conferences and is a regular contributor to CNBC, CNN, and other major media outlets. He has also advised government leaders on matters of innovation policy, entrepreneurship, and competitiveness. Currently, Gary is pioneering an effort to reinvent management by harnessing the power of open innovation. The Management Innovation Exchange, known as MIX, is an online community where the world's most progressive leaders share their ideas. The challenge is how to build organizations that are fit for the future and fit for human beings. The MIX is supported by McKinsey and Company, the Harvard Business Review, and others. Gary describes himself as a management renegade, and I fully concur with that. Ladies and gentlemen, Gary Hamel.
Well, thank you, Gillian, and thank you to the Commonwealth Club and the London Business School alumni for hosting me this evening. Great pleasure to be with you and have a conversation. You know, I'm always a little bit worried when one gets introduced as being a professor on a faculty, because basically when you tell people you're a professor, they assume you're irrelevant. And if you tell them you're a strategy professor, they like guarantee that. But nevertheless, what I'm going to talk to you about this evening, it's certainly stretching, but hopefully it's not theory. It's a challenge that we're deeply involved in, that we're hoping to change the way large organizations all over the world operate. But I want to start with an observation or two. I lived in London for quite a long time, and when I moved back to the Bay Area, and I live just a few miles from where we're meeting this evening, and I started hanging out with people from Stanford University, people in the medical school, engineering, and so on. What struck me was the audacity, the ambition they had for changing the world. And I thought about those of us who work in and around large organizations. And I think often in some kind of way we suffer from a kind of ambition deficit disorder. And we believe that the way organizations are run today is pretty much the way they're always going to be run. We can tweak at the margin, we can change a few things, but we really can't change them at their core. And yet, when I was talking to my colleagues and my friends there at Stanford, there are people in engineering who are trying to master nanoscale manufacturing, people in computer science trying to create machines that can think, people in medicine trying to cure the world's toughest diseases. And if you look back through history, really as human beings, we are defined by the challenges we take on. And, you know, big problems don't always yield big breakthroughs, but little problems never do. The Nobel Prize-winning zoologist Peter Medawar, he said that years and years ago. He said, dull and piffling problems yield dull and piffling answers. And I've always believed that life is too short to work on inconsequential problems. You know, I was probably as many of you, I was mesmerized by the images coming back from the Curiosity rover as it explored the surface of Mars. And I got thinking, if you were that team at NASA trying to build this vehicle with this amazing landing system, who would you benchmark, right? It's not clear to me. And yet so often when we're challenged in our organizations, public, private, large or small, we're challenged to think in new ways. Our first question is always, who else has done it? We want a benchmark. And that's a great question, but it's mostly a question for followers. So I'm going to talk about a challenge tonight where I don't think we have all the answers yet, but I think it's a challenge that is worthy of every mind, of all the passion, all the energy that sits in this room. And I'd like to start, if I can, with kind of a question. If you asked a member of, let's say, the U.S. Navy SEAL Team 6, or an account executive at Cisco, or a financial advisor at Merrill Lynch, or a guard at the Hongkou Detention Center in Shanghai, or a nurse within Britain's National Health Service, or a Catholic priest ministering to the poor in a Rio favela, or a software engineer at Google, or one of the 2 million associates at Walmart, or if we could go back 2,000 years and talk to a centurion in the Roman infantry, if we asked any of those people to draw a picture of their organization, to give us an image of the organization that they work for, I think most times they would draw a picture that looks like that traditional organizational hierarchy with the familiar lines and boxes. Now, if you think about that structure, that diagram with that cascade of lines and boxes, that is not a diagram of a network. That's not a picture of an ecosystem. It's not a representation of a community. It's a diagram of formal hierarchy, a hierarchy that structurally and preemptively empowers the few at the expense of the many. It is, in a real way, kind of the exoskeleton of bureaucracy. And in one form or another, this has been humanity's most durable social structure. It's simple. It's scalable. Those clear lines of authority, the cascading goals, the pliant subordinates, the inescapable oversight, all of that enables us to do large-scale things. Whether that is, 4,000 years ago building the pyramids, whether it's Henry Ford building an assembly line for the world's large-scale automobile plant. In fact, if you think about it, the modern industrial corporation is nothing more than a mashup of that traditional hierarchical structure and industrial engineering, with its emphasis on measurement and efficiency and repeatability. And that kind of model, that hierarchical model, that bureaucratic model, is still the standard operating system of virtually every organization, large and small, across the planet. And most organizations still adhere to a kind of a common template where there's this cascade of authority, big leaders appoint little leaders, power is a function of where you sit in that hierarchy, resources are allocated top down, employees compete to climb the ladder there, senior executives set direction, and so on. In fact, it's hard for us even to imagine another way of managing, another way of accomplishing things at scale. Think about it. Could you imagine, for example, a large organization where there are no titles at all, where you don't find a single vice president, senior vice president, administrator, department head, and so on? Could you imagine an organization where we crowdsource strategy, an organization where there is no promotion, where salaries are set by your peers? Hard to imagine that. And part of the reason is most of us have never seen organizations like that. We've worked in and around organizations that fit a very common template, and to one degree or another, we are all prisoners of precedent. You know, it's interesting, when the Iberians, when the Spanish and Portuguese discovered the New World, so-called discovered, came to the New World, the Native Americans at that time had not yet invented the wheel. And you kind of want to think about what would your reaction have been the first time in your life you saw a wheel? You had been hauling things on a sledge behind you. One day you see the wheel, go like, are you kidding me? Really? Like, we've been dragging this crap all this time? Wow, who knew there was a better way? And I think that's a little bit where we are today with management and organization. We have caught in the past. We can't imagine new possibilities. And tonight I want to try to help you at least imagine those new possibilities. You know, I lived in England. There were a lot of colorful expressions that I got familiar with. Dog's breakfast, argy-bargy, slap and tickle. Some of these I should probably not explain. But one of my favorite British expressions was when they talk about a busted flush. And that literally meant a toilet that was broken and therefore, not only ugly but now useless as well. And I'm going to argue tonight that old hierarchical bureaucratic model that we're so familiar with in our schools, our churches, and government, and corporations, that thing is now becoming a huge liability. You know, the truth is, as managers, as leaders around the world, we've been fiddling at the margins. We flatten the corporate hierarchy, but we haven't eliminated it. We eulogize empowerment, but few leaders surrender their decision-making prerogatives. We encourage employees, associates to speak up, but we don't let them choose their own leaders. So we've kind of denounced bureaucracy, but we really haven't dethroned it. And I think we have yet to invent a substitute for this, something that gives us all the advantages without the cost, but I think we have to do that. I think bureaucracy must die, and we're going to talk a little bit about how that might happen. But first, why? You know, why? What's the cost here? Why does it need to be supplanted and replaced? Well, I would argue a couple of core reasons. First of all, I think those old leadership and management structures are just inherently inefficient. They exert a kind of management tax on every organization, some of it visible, much of it invisible. And perhaps that didn't matter much when every organization was run this way, but increasingly there's some progressive companies that aren't. But think about it. Any company that has ranks of managers is subject to a kind of tax. First of all, there's simply the overhead. Even if you have a kind of 1 to 10 span of control, let's say, as an organization grows, you have more and more managers versus those frontline associates and employees. Because as you grow, you have managers now who are managing other managers. And so that population grows and grows proportionate to the people out there right on the front lines talking to customers, doing their work. Secondly, in that traditional hierarchy, weirdly enough, I think it increases the risk of calamitous decisions. We all know that as human beings, we're subject to hubris and denial and arrogance. Those can corrupt the decisions we make. And in most organizations, senior leaders thoroughly vet the ideas that come from below. If you're a young employee, a junior employee, your ideas will get scrutinized and be put through the ringer. But as those decisions become bigger and momentous, as you move to the top of that organization, there are fewer and fewer people who can challenge the decision maker. And that's why the business press is filled with these, you know, heroic decisions, putting, for example, Royal Bank of Scotland, ABM AMRO together, these big deals, mega deals, or executives that have missed critical turning points on the road to the future. And it's kind of ironic that the bigger the decision gets, the fewer people there are who can challenge the decision maker. Or as I like to say, if you give somebody monarchical power, sooner or later there will be a royal screw-up. You can kind of bank on that. We also see organizations where there's just a lot of friction, right? As ideas try to work their way up through that gauntlet, climb that hierarchy, decision cycles get longer, response times get slower, and that's very costly in today's world. Then there's the risk of bias. Again, in a traditional hierarchy, sooner or later, every idea is going to meet somebody who has the power to say an absolute no. One person will get to act as judge, jury, executioner. We're not going to go there. We're not going to invest in that opportunity. And so you find that often big decisions are better for that decision maker than they are for an organization, the organization as a whole. And they reflect that person's bias is not necessarily the best thing for the company going forward. And finally, I think perhaps most dangerously, that old management model, that old leadership model enforces a kind of tyranny. And the problem here isn't the occasional control freak boss. It's much deeper, much more institutionalized than that. Think about it. If you walk around San Francisco or any major city around the world, most of the people you'll meet today can go out and buy an automobile. It might be a used one. You might have to take a loan out. You'll talk to your spouse, your partner, but then you can go buy a car. You take that same individual and you put them inside of a government bureaucracy or a Fortune 500 company, that individual cannot requisition a $200 office chair without somebody else's permission. It's like the moment we hang an employee badge on them, they become stupid. You know, we can't trust them anymore. And of course, what we know from a ton of research is that initiative and autonomy are correlated. When you shrink an individual's scope of authority, you also shrink their incentive to dream, to imagine, to contribute. And this is an extraordinary cost that our organizations suffer. So not only is that model inefficient, I would also argue it kind of makes organizations systemically incompetent. I wrote a paper years and years ago called The Core Competence of the Corporation. And I think if I was rewriting that today, I would call it The Core Incompetence of the Corporation. Because it turns out that these large organizations, public and private, all share some kind of systematic disabilities. One of those is they're not very adaptable. Think about it. What typically does it take to get an organization to change itself at its core? What usually has to happen before we'll ask these fundamental questions about, does this model work? What business are we in? Are we really serving the customer? Typically, it takes a valley of the shadow of death experience, right? Some kind of deep crisis like Nokia's been through over the last few years. I remember some years ago talking to one of the leaders at Nokia. He said, Gary, we're growing like a rocket. I said, did you notice that rockets tend to follow a parabolic curve, right? It's like up and down. And at some point after the organization, after the company's fallen off a financial cliff, at some point the board rouses itself, it replaces the leader. But this is just all too familiar. The fact is, deep change is almost always belated, it's convulsive, it's infrequent. In fact, it's kind of odd to think about it, but this kind of deep strategic change, reorientation in the most sophisticated companies in the world, that kind of change happens the same way it does in poorly governed third world dictatorships, right? Catastrophically and infrequently and so on, and this we have to change. We simply can't afford, in a world of accelerating change, we can no longer afford organizations that have to go through this kind of experience to redirect and reorient, where literally, typically, you have to have a coup. Because almost always this kind of change comes only once you've replaced the leadership. So we have to do better than that. We also find that our organizations are really not very innovative, not at their core. Today, it's kind of odd. We almost expect that in every industry, it's going to be the relative newcomers that create the new wealth. It's going to be, you know, Apple or Spotify or Skype or Amazon or Google, whatever it may be. But new companies who come, break the rules, create the new markets, the new value. And what's odd is that it's the incumbents who had all the resources. They had the technology, the patents, the people, the big research budgets, the facilities. And yet we know in our hearts today that resources really are a poor substitute for innovation. Resource advantages don't buy you as much as they used to. A recent study by McKinsey and Company, the consultants, found that around the world, only about 24% of senior executives are satisfied with the innovation performance of their companies. And mostly, they're not benchmarking Apple or Google. They're benchmarking their lackluster peers, and they're still disappointed. So there's something about the way we manage that makes our organizations not very innovative. And finally, I would say they're also often not very inspiring places to work. And there's a lot of evidence that bears this out. Towers Watson, a big global HR consulting company, they occasionally do surveys of employee engagement around the world. And they ask people questions like, do you believe your ideas matter here? Do you feel connected to this company's purpose? And in a recent study of tens of thousands of people all across the world, the data was really sobering. They found that around the world, only about 14% of people at work are highly engaged in what they're doing. A bigger proportion is completely disengaged. These are the maliciously compliant. And then you have the kind of people in the middle, moderately engaged, really don't give a poop, but they show up and take the paycheck and so on. And I was looking at this data, and I thought, what if we weren't managers or leaders, but what if we were maybe teachers or physicians? If somebody told you as a physician that of the 100 people that came through your office last week, you actually killed a quarter of them, right? 60-some percent, nothing happened, and yes, 14% got better. Or at the end of a school year, if somebody told you that only 14% of the kids had learned anything, right, that would be a scandal. And yet, year after year, we see this data as leaders, as managers, and we just kind of accept it. And the kind of sad fact is that the way we manage our human resources makes people less resourceful than they might be. Maybe this didn't matter in the industrial economy. Maybe it didn't matter in the knowledge economy. It sure matters in the creative economy. Because in that economy, the thing that creates value is initiative and passion and creativity, and those things cannot be commanded. They are gifts that people bring to work every day, or they don't. And as we know, mostly they don't. And for a long time, as I thought about this data, why aren't people more engaged? My assumption was they're not engaged because the work isn't engaging. When you walk around, you know, any city, you'll see a lot of people, and you are glad you don't have their jobs. And yet, when you ask them, about 85% of people will tell you, the work is okay, I like my work. So you have to go deeper. And if you ask a different set of questions, if you ask a question like, do you believe your manager, that leadership team, really sees you as an individual, not a human resource, a human being? Do they take account of your needs, your feelings? Are they open with you? Are they honest with you? Then you start to see that most folks around the world, they really don't feel that they are treated with dignity, that they are treated with respect, that management is open and honest with them. Less than 40% would tell you those things are true in their workplace. I was writing a little blog about this a while back, and I was writing it for a fairly conservative website who often cuts my best comments. Because I was trying to sum this all up, and I said, it turns out it's not so much that work sucks, but management sure blows. And they just, I don't know why, but they just like, they cut that right out. So as you think about these top-down structures, they have an increasing set of liabilities. And we could kind of unpack all that and go deep. I want to talk about only one, just for a moment, just to go one level deeper, on how those structures impede change. Here we are, living in a world that seems to be all punctuation and no equilibrium. A world that sooner or later will challenge every institution to reinvent itself in ways for which it has no precedent. Where the most important question for an individual, an institution, or even a society is, are we changing as fast as the world around us? And yet we know that the more you concentrate power and responsibility in any kind of human system, the less resilient it's going to be. Let me give you an example. A few years ago, somebody sent me a kind of a chart that had been passed around in an organization, something that went out to 70,000 employees. And this chart listed all the behaviors that they wanted people to have on one axis. People, you know, we want leaders who will build alignment and communicate openly and implement with excellence, all that lovely HR BS. And then they had the levels of the organization on the other axis, executives, managers, and individual contributors. But what struck me is one of those categories, one of those behaviors was they wanted people who think strategically. But yet against that behavior, the only little X was under the column for executives. Think about that. You've just told 99% of your 70,000 employees that you really don't have to think. You don't have to worry about the disruptive technology, about those new markets, about emerging customer needs. Just shut up and do your job. I tell you, you know, this is why Dilbert is funny. You can't make this stuff up, right? But let me give you a case example. And I'm not going to pick on this company. I'm just going to use them as an example of how this impacts just about every organization. But think about Microsoft, right? Once an amazing industry pioneer, but for the last 10 years, their share price has basically been flat. And it's not, I think, unfair to say that they have been late to almost every new trend in software for the better part of 20 years. Late onto the web initially, late in search, late in advertising-supported software, late in software as a service, late to the cloud, just late and late and late again. And for most of that time frame, for most of that 20 years, the chief software architect of Microsoft was Bill Gates. So if you had an idea for a radical new software architecture, whose permission would you have to get? You'd have to go through Bill Gates. And like so many leaders, I would argue, lots of his mental models were locked up in the past, in a different industry paradigm. In fact, if you want, the simplest explanation, I think, of why large organizations ultimately miss the future, ultimately fail, is that the executive team fails to write off its depreciating intellectual capital. So you think about that organizational pyramid and you ask, well, where in that pyramid are people going to have a lot of their emotional equity invested in the past? At the top. Where in that pyramid are people that have to defend decisions that were made 5 or 10 or 20 years ago? At the top. And then who do we give responsibility to for setting strategy and direction? That top team. You know, I was thinking about this. Think about three of the most amazing entrepreneurs of the last few years. We're sitting here close to Silicon Valley. You think about Steve Jobs at Apple, Larry Page at Google, and Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook. What would happen if all of these guys had reported to Bill Gates, right? I mean, that's all, basically all, and it's not a knock on Bill Gates. That guy's an amazingly smart, good-hearted person. But nobody's going to have a vision again and again and again. So I'd like us to start to think, is there actually an alternative here? And to think about that, we got to back up just for a moment. and ask ourselves, what problem was that traditional hierarchical organization invented to solve? What problem was modern management invented to solve? And I would argue that largely it was invented to solve the problem of efficiency at scale. Max Weber, a famous German sociologist, he was celebrating this amazing new organization 100 years ago, and it was amazing. Right? If you have a mobile device in every pocket, if you have a couple of cars in the garage, if you are not spending 80% of your time growing your own food, all of that is thanks to a set of management pioneers 100 years ago who figured out this new organizational form called bureaucracy, hierarchy mashed together with industrial engineering. And Max Weber was celebrating this. He said, this is superior to anything human beings have ever invented in its precision, its stability, its discipline, its reliability. The dilemma is, those are less and less the things that matter in the 21st century. Those are table stakes. They're important, but they're really not advantages. And so we find ourselves today, we find ourselves with organizations that are big and efficient and disciplined and well integrated, but they're not very adaptable. They're not very innovative. They're not inspiring places to work. They're not very entrepreneurial. One of my favorite authors, Richard Florida, he wrote a book a few years back called The Rise of the Creative Class. And he had a wonderful, you know, he just captured this, I think, very clearly there. He said, the biggest issue at stake in this emerging age is the tension between creativity and organization. We seem to know how to get one, but we can't quite find the other. You know, I've never met a leader in any organization. I've never met a leader who is a booster for bureaucracy, who said, yeah, I wish we had more of that. Never. But I've almost never met somebody who has an alternative. And that's why most of the attacks on bureaucracy, taking out a layer or two or marginally increasing empowerment, most of those attacks on bureaucracy have been tactical rather than existential. They've been kind of like shoulder jabs rather than a left hook to the temple. And now I think we have to, like, hit this thing harder and go deeper. You know, there's in a way, there's kind of almost an ideological challenge here. And ideology is not a word we use much when we think about organizations and the way they're run. But if you think about it, if you go back through human history, the hinges of human history have been ideological conflicts and debates between theism and atheism, between free will and determinism, or protectionism and free trade. And what you find in those debates is that sometimes the dust never settles. Sometimes the ideologies, you know, there's never going to be a winner. Theism versus atheism. I think that debate is going to rage for a very long time yet. In other cases, one ideological pole kind of wins out. Most economists would tell you that free trade is better than protectionism. It doesn't mean it always wins out in the marketplace, but it's better for human outcomes. We just know this. There's very little debate about it. And yet there are other kinds of ideological debates where it's not one or the other. There's a deep tension between the two things, like community and individualism. Both of those ideas are important. And I have a sense that the ideology that underlies our organizations, that ideology is really lopsided. It's asymmetric. You know, if you want to kind of think about what is the ideology of management, one way of getting at that is go pick up a thesaurus in any language, and go look at manage as a verb, to manage. Look at that phrase. And when you look at that phrase, to manage, almost in every language, the number one synonym is to control. Right? That's that artifact of the Industrial Revolution. Management is about driving the variety out of organizations, making sure there's conformance to standards and schedules and budgets. And yet today we're in a world where it's the irregular people with irregular ideas who create the irregular wealth. And they're struggling inside of organizations that were built around the ideology of controlism. In fact, again, Max Weber said this very, very well. The earlier part of that quote I just shared, he said, bureaucracy is the most rational known means of carrying out imperative control over human beings. And yet, if you want to build an organization that's adaptable, that's innovative, that's inspiring, I can tell you, control isn't what you need. Right? You need freedom. Freedom to go around channels, freedom to take risks, freedom to experiment, freedom to put your feet up on the desk for a few hours and think about a new idea, freedom to fail. And so we have this kind of ideological, if you like, tension between control and freedom. You know, it's interesting, if you think about it, I would argue this technology of management, how we control and budget and coordinate and so on, That was the most important social technology of the 20th century. Management, literally, this is the technology of human accomplishment that has allowed us to do extraordinary things. And yet now we see an amazing new social technology, the social web, built around a whole different set of things, folksonomies and social networks, opinion markets, crowdsourcing, online forums, and so on. The technology of management was built around the ideology of control. The web is built around the ideology of freedom. It has enhanced personal freedom in ways we could have never expected, anticipated. The freedom to communicate, to create, to connect, to challenge, to choose. And of course, that old architecture, that old management hierarchy, it was a little bit like the old telephone system. Those of you who are old enough to remember, like a real black telephone that sat at the end of the network, you had to lease it from the phone company. It was a completely stupid device. All the intelligence was in the center, in that big switch that controlled all of the telephone calls. If you wanted to do something new, you had to reprogram that switch. It was expensive and risky, like a corporate, you know, top-down change program. And then the web came. And the web is all periphery and very little center. It's it's completely architecturally different. And so we have this tension now between control and freedom. And yet in most organizations, control is what's really baked into every process. It's like the blue and blue cheese. And I think there's an assumption often on the part of leaders, there's an assumption that control and freedom are mutually exclusive. If you express it mathematically, control multiplied by freedom equals a constant. Because if I go to a CEO, a leader, I say, you know, you have to dramatically increase the level of autonomy that people have. Dramatically expand their discretion. The first pushback I get is, well, maybe, but we still have to meet our budgets. We have to deliver flawless customer service. We are held accountable for, you know, all kinds of compliance issues in the regulatory environment. How in the world can I give people more freedom? So the assumption is that these things are kind of counterposed. If you had like x-axis, y-axis, freedom and control, there's kind of a line that runs, you know, upper left, lower right. And you can choose where you want to be on that line, but it's an absolute trade-off. Right? You can be a company like Intel making 28 nanometer chips with amazing precision, controlling thousands of variables. Or you can be a pants down prince in Las Vegas having a good time. Right? You can choose where you want to be. A lot of freedom, a lot of control. But you kind of have to make a choice. You know, it's interesting. I think back in 1983, if my memory serves me right, Tom Peters, a great management thinker, wrote a book called In Search of Excellence. And one of the companies he celebrated back then was Hewlett-Packard, one of the most innovative companies in the world at that time. Every time a business got to about $50 million, Hewlett-Packard split it up, constantly morphing like an amoeba, moving into new markets and so on. But as it grew, it lost a lot of that innovation mojo. And today you have a company that's tightly run, highly controlled, you know, but has lost a lot of its innovation energy. Meg Whitman, current CEO, we're going to see whether she can turn that thing around, but it's going to be a tough challenge. So for me, the real question is, how do you get off that curve? How do you shift that frontier out? How do we have a lot of control where we need it and a lot of freedom where we need it? And so, again, is this even possible, or is this just kind of a vain hope? Let me give you a couple of examples. Let me give you a quick example. A company you may not have heard about before. I wrote an article a few months back for the Harvard Business Review about them. But it's a company based here in California, up in the Central Valley, near Los Banos. Their biggest factory is near Los Banos. And it's the world's largest processor of tomatoes. If you've had salsa, ketchup, spaghetti sauce, almost for sure you've had something that has come through their factory. So they take in tons and tons of tomatoes every day. They process it through a huge industrial kind of plant. They have revenues of over $700 million a year, about 500 employees. And in this company, you will not find a single manager, supervisor, department head, not a single title, no formal hierarchy whatsoever. Now, an economist would tell you this is impossible. Because an economist looks at the world as having only two kinds of organizations. There are markets, which are decentralized, but a market cannot run a tomato plant. And then you have hierarchies, they're centralized, firms, companies, they're centralized. You know, and they're capable of great coordination, but all the power tends to reside at the top. What they've never seen, what a typical economist has never seen, is a company that's radically decentralized and perfectly synchronized. But I have, and I'm going to tell you about it. The company's name is Morningstar, and I kind of got interested in them when I was reading their organizational vision statement. And I'll share just a bit of it with you. It starts by saying all of our team members at Morningstar, and these are mostly what you would think of as blue-collar employees in industrial manufacturing, agribusiness, all of our team members will be self-managing professionals. It's an interesting way to look at blue-collar employees. They will initiate communication, coordinate their activities with their colleagues, customers, suppliers, and other folks, and they're going to do all of that, and listen to this, they're going to do all of that absent directives from others. Can you imagine saying to the first level people in your organization, we want you to do your work absent direction from anybody else? I've never met an organization. I've never seen that before. And remember, this is not some darling web startup. This is a vertically integrated, capital-intensive business making a product that has human health implications at the other end. So I said, I'd like to know some more. So I went and had some chance to talk to these folks. Very, very interesting company. When you get there, what people will tell you is, I report not to a boss, because I don't have a boss, I report to my mission. When you get hired by Morningstar, you'll work a while, and then they ask you, think about your job and write a personal mission statement. Well, I'm unloading tomatoes off those trucks, and I want to do it as efficiently as I can with least damage to the tomatoes and respect the environment, so you write your mission statement. Now, that gets a little bit more flesh on it, because then you negotiate what they call a colleague letter of understanding. You negotiate your responsibilities with your peers, not a boss. There's no boss setting your, you know, KPIs, your targets. You negotiate this with your peers. And you say, the peers upstream, downstream, this is what I'm going to do for you this year. Those documents can run to 10, 15 pages. They're very detailed with all kinds of targets, and your colleagues are going to hold you accountable there. But it's really almost like independent contractors in a marketplace bargaining, you know, what are you going to do for me? What am I going to do for you? There's an enormous level of discretionary authority in this company. If you are running, let's say, a big boiler that's producing steam to cook these tomatoes and you need a new piece of equipment, there's no central purchasing office to go to. There's no CFO to get a sign off. You're responsible for going out and finding the supplies you need, finding the vendor, getting a contract drawn up with them, getting the equipment, making sure it meets specifications, and then, yes, somebody's going to write a check when you ask them to write a check. But imagine giving everybody in your organization access to the company checkbook, because that's basically what you see here. That takes a heck of a lot of trust to do that. There are in this company, there are no kind of formal job titles, but people absolutely work to take on bigger and bigger jobs, more responsibility. That's how you grow your compensation, grow your respect with your peers. So there's a lot of opportunity to grow and take on more work, but there are no formal promotions. In fact, as somebody said to me there, they said, Gary, we don't spend any time at all competing for the scarce resource called promotion. We only compete to add more value. Now think about it. How does an organization like this work? And when you look at this company or you look at another kind of similar company, W.L. Gore, some of you know of them. They're famous for Gore-Tex, a $3 billion roughly company, about 10,000 employees with no formal hierarchy at all. They talk about their organization as a lattice, not a hierarchy, where leaders are chosen by the led. The first time I went to visit them, it was kind of a strange experience. People were giving me their business cards, and there were no titles on the cards. And that, I in most situations, I like to see the titles, because that's the only way I know who to suck up to. That day I had to be nice to everybody all day, because who knew, right? And on a few of the cards, it had the word leader. So I said, well, how do you get to be a leader here? Is there leadership development? No. Leadership appointments? No. Well, how do you get to be a leader? Well, you get to be a leader when people ask you to lead them. Think about this. In business schools and magazines and books, we talk about leadership. We use that term so loosely, so lightly. But I would argue you cannot have a conversation about leadership unless you start with two assumptions. You first of all have to start with the assumption that you have no formal authority at all. You're not the head of anything. And therefore, number two, you have no sanctions. You can't fire somebody, demote them, dock their pay. And if you start with those two conditions, no formal authority, no sanctions, if you can still get something done, by golly, you're a leader. If you don't start with those two assumptions, you're not talking about leadership, you're talking about how you use bureaucratic power. That's okay. Let's just not pretend it's a conversation about leadership. And so at Gore, at Morningstar, they're saying, we want to make sure that every person in this organization who's a leader is somebody people actually want to follow. And the only way you will really know that is if those folks can vote their leader off the island. And if you can't do that, how do you know? Natural hierarchies. Think about what you find on the web, right? The talk this evening is called The End of Hierarchy. I think it's actually a little bit mislabeled. I would call it The End of Formal Hierarchy. The web is filled with hierarchy. Go to any discussion forum, look anywhere on the social web, look in the blogosphere. You will see people have more influence, more followers, right? People, you know, tweet them more often or whatever, link to them more often. Those people have enormous influence. You can go calculate your clout score, K-L-O-U-T, right? Your influence score within the world of social media. But all of those hierarchies are built from the bottom up. And the moment you stop adding value, people stop following you. So back to Morningstar. What makes this work? Well, one of the reasons it works is that every single person in that company, every single associate has real-time performance information. You know how profitable your business is, how the other businesses are in this company. They're divided into about 20 different business units. Each has its own P&L. And it's easy to tell who's making money, who's not. So everybody shares a very clear scoreboard. Number two, yeah, you have a lot of discretion. You can spend the company's money, but if you waste it or you make a bad investment, your colleagues will fire you. And I'll tell you how that happens. So guess what? You do a lot of consulting. Before buying that expensive piece of equipment, you go talk to every smart person in the company you can. You ask them to check your arithmetic, to look at your assumptions, to tell you if you got something wrong. You also find there a lot of skills have been pushed very low into the organization. About half the folks at Morningstar have been through training programs that teach them how to do return on investment calculations, net present value, internal rate of return. In fact, they said, Gary, we will put our, quotes, blue-collar employees up against your MBA students, and I think our guys will do better financial modeling than your smart students. And they might be right. And the idea was, instead of moving decisions up to where people have expertise, why don't we push expertise down to where people have the context, the information, living close to customer, close to the marketplace. You also see a kind of a due process there. If you don't think I'm doing my job as a colleague, you come challenge me on that. If we disagree, we find a third party to mediate. If at the end of that I still think I'm doing fine and you don't, we get to bring six people together, a jury of our peers. They look at all the evidence. And in an extreme case, they may say, Gary, you got to go. You're not working here. And believe me, when six of your peers tell you it's time to go, you go, right? No use hanging around. And finally, they have really what I would call 360-degree compensation, like W.L. Gore. The colleagues appoint compensation committees. They hear from all of your peers, how is Gary doing? Is he living up to all of those agreements that he signed? And that drives your compensation. At W.L. Gore, they have a quite simple, and in some ways a fairly brutal process. At the end of every year, they will give you, as an associate there, they give you a list of 20, 25 names of your peers. And you have to rank them from 1 to 20 on how much value they added. None of this HR nonsense of 5 dimensions and 6 points and whatever it is. It's just like, you're smart. You know what creates value. Rank these people. They take those rankings. They put them on a bell-shaped curve. That drives your compensation. And by the way, if they've asked you, if your team has asked you to lead them at Gore, and you come number 7 out of 20, that's a problem. But it provokes some very interesting behaviors. Because when you know you're going to be ranked by peers and that drives your compensation, guess what? You start behaving like an entrepreneur. All year long you're asking, where else can I add value? How do I do something for my colleagues? Maybe I need, you know, go get some new skills. Maybe I should be working on another team. But it turns everyone into kind of a personal entrepreneur. Number 2, you start behaving collaboratively. People will say, you know, I'm really busy, but if somebody, if a colleague comes and wants some help, wow, that's a tough call. At Gore, every colleague, every associate has the right to make their own commitments. Nobody can give an order. But you know at the end of the year, your colleagues are going to hold you accountable for the value you created. So, you know, it's interesting. There are alternatives, my friends, to that kind of standard model. And we don't look at them very often, but part of what we're doing on the Management Innovation Exchange, we are bringing together literally hundreds of these bleeding-edge examples from all over the world. You know, think about it. If one of us is sitting here this evening, if one of you suddenly started floating up out of your chair, mysteriously rising towards the ceiling, first we check for cables, then we do an exorcism, right? And then we have to say, you know, like maybe sometimes gravity is contingent. Maybe somebody just figured out a way to break free of gravity. I can tell you there are organizations that are breaking free of that old model, that are finding ways of building organizations that can change as fast as change itself, where innovation is the work of every single person every single day, where people bring all of their passions to work. And I think the secret to this, in a way, the secret is just distinguishing what and how. You know, accountability and control and efficiency and discipline, these are always going to be important in our organizations. The question is, how do we get those? Right? Historically, we got that kind of discipline and control through a lot of procedures, very tight supervision, little discretionary authority, little self-directed time, and by golly, that will put you in control. But it will also destroy adaptability and innovation and passion. So the question is not whether as human beings, ultimately we have some constraints around us. Of course we're going to have constraints. Think about the difference, though, between putting somebody in a straitjacket where you feel constrained, and if you're a little bit claustrophobic, you'll be panicky real fast. Think about the difference between that and when somebody you love gives you a hug. Right? Both of them are constraining, but they feel completely different in the moment. So it used to be control came from the hierarchy and from all of those rules and from fear of screwing up, from the weight of precedent. I think there are other models where the control comes from peers, it comes from transparency, from shared values, from shared aspirations. So let's take a last minute or two and then we're going to have some questions. Let me try to just get real practical for a moment or two. What is it going to take to build organizations, to build the world's, you know, first crop of truly post-bureaucratic organizations? And I think, you know, we're beginning to see some of what that might take. We know that, for example, you have to break big units into smaller units, thereby creating opportunity for more leaders to emerge. You cannot have leadership from everywhere if you have monolithic organizations, thousands of people in a particular organizational unit, and the most progressive companies on the planet understand this. One of my favorite companies, a large Chinese company, 80,000 employees, they've broken that company up into 2,000 different profit centers. So disaggregating those large things, because today I can get coordination without centralization. I can get it through communities, through horizontal communication. So secondly, organizations are going to have to start to support the formation of more informal teams, self-organizing communities where natural leaders emerge, that work across the boundaries. I've seen this happen in as unlikely an organization as the Anglican Church. Young vicar there re-energizing his parish church by turning the old model upside down where, you know, the vicar would tell you, here's the programs we're going to run and we hope you'll give us some money and show up. Turning that upside down. Saying we're going to create mission-shaped communities built around natural leaders in our organization. The church is there simply to catalyze and to help support you. And in a matter of a few months, they've grown a church from 500 to 1,600 people, unleashed all kinds of amazing new initiatives, bringing social services and other valuable things to their community. But by really thinking about how do you build communities on that opt-in model, it means pushing P&L responsibility down to the lowest level possible. I think of an organization like Whole Foods, where those team members in the store, in produce, in meat, packaged goods, where they are responsible for hiring, they are responsible for setting prices, for merchandise selection, and they're really running those as real little businesses. It's going to mean syndicating the work of leadership, setting strategy and direction to the entire organization. I think of a company like Red Hat, a leader in kind of open source software, where when it came to redo their strategy, that became a social process involving everyone across the company, using more peer-based systems to set compensation, as you saw at Gore, for example. You know, it's interesting, when I was talking to the founder of Morningstar, Chris Ruffer, after having spent some time with his company, I said, it's amazing, you built a company with no managers. He says, Gary, you're an idiot. Well, he wasn't quite that rude, but almost. Gary, you're an idiot. I build a company where everybody's a manager. And I think this is what's going to happen. We are going to start to syndicate the work of managing and leading to every single person. Now, what does that mean for you? How do you exercise influence without authority? What is it going to mean to be a leader in these new organizations? And you're going to have to develop, I think, a different set of skills. You can no longer rely on that hierarchical power. And when I look at people that other people want to follow, you see some common traits. These people are seers. They are living in the future. They have a compelling vision of what could be. And as human beings, we're constantly looking forward. We love to sign on with individuals who we think are already working on the next big thing. So you have to cultivate that capability to think about the future, to look around corners. People who have this kind of influence, they're contrarians. They've escaped the shackles of conventional wisdom. They're eager to help others stage a kind of jailbreak. And it's just exciting to be around free-spirited thinkers. They open our minds to new possibilities. That's something else you can cultivate in yourself. Be a liberator. These people are also architects. They are building new social platforms that facilitate contribution, that facilitate collaboration. You think of Jimmy Wales, right, creating Wikipedia. No real formal authority at all. But he created a platform that allowed thousands of people all over the world to help bring together all this human knowledge in a new way. They are mentors, right? They don't hoard power, they give it away. I think of Mary Parker Follett, perhaps the most prescient management thinker who ever lived, writing back in the early years of the 20th century. She said, the work of a leader is to create more leaders. They are connectors. Right? They have that gift for combinational chemistry, for putting together ideas and individuals. They're inveterate networkers. And they help connect people with sponsors, with like-minded peers, with resources, and their value comes from helping make those connections. They're bushwhackers. Right? They're fighting bureaucracy every day. They're trying to clear the trail for new ideas. They understand the risks of breaching protocol, going around channels, but they're more committed to doing the right thing than to doing things right. And those are the people we want to follow. They're guardians. They're guardians of the institution's values. They're enemies of expediency. And they have an unflinching commitment to a higher purpose that inspires others, encourages followers. And finally, they see themselves as citizens. They're not anarchists, they're activists. They care about their institutions. They love their colleagues. They challenge the status quo, but that comes from an abiding commitment to doing as much good as possible for as many people as possible. They are other-centered. They are not self-centered. You cultivate those qualities in yourself. I can tell you, you can lead in any kind of an organization anywhere, whether you have formal authority or not. So this is the vision, at least, I have. I've seen enough to know it's maybe possible. And I'd like to take a few questions now and hear from you what's on your mind and what would you like to ask of me.
I don't think. Okay, good. I would like to ask. I don't have a question. I just want to make an announcement that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is The End of Hierarchy with Gary Hamel. We have just a few moments left for questions, but if we'd like to start over here, please do ask your question into the microphone.
Here, Gary. I want to say that I really appreciate your ability to be inspirational and pragmatic at the same time. The question that I have is, our organizations, you focus primarily on organizations, and they exist in a larger context, in a larger narrative. And that narrative very much drives the quality of purpose, for example. So we live in a narrative of consumption and growth, and growth is a good thing. What if it wasn't a good thing? How do you envision changing the larger narrative in which organizations operate?
You know, I think it's a really good question. We've seen over the last few years what happens when you have greed and avarice and short-termism that is untempered by any sense of a more noble purpose. And I think, you know, we have to hold organizations of all kinds accountable in that way. And the good news is it is increasingly happening. Because the web is creating, I think it's kind of leveling up our expectations of organizations. We expect them to behave in the same ethical ways wherever they operate in the world. And malfeasance today is very, very rapidly exposed. So I'm fairly optimistic with that kind of transparency that organizations are going to become more accountable, but it's our responsibility to make them so. And I would argue if you think from within an organization, I think that we have kind of suffered, many organizations have suffered because we really haven't been driven by noble values. You know, even if you think about the language of business, we talk about advantage, superiority, solutions, and so on. But how often inside of these organizations do you hear words like love, truth, beauty, justice, honor? And yet those are the ideals that have inspired extraordinary contribution all down through human history. So I don't know how to build. You know, I meet many CEOs who say they want to build a high-performing organization. I don't know how to do that if the organization is built around values that are venal rather than transcendent. So those of us inside organizations, we have to have the courage to fight for those values, to stand up for them. If we're outside as consumers, as citizens, we have a responsibility to call leaders to account.
Hey there, Gary. My name is Kartik Ram. I run an e-commerce marketplace company in Singapore, in Asia. And now, bucking hierarchies works in the U.S. to a degree. A lot of startups do it. In Asia, things are slightly different. So I wanted you to talk about two contexts. One is, have you noticed anything saliently different in the rest of the world? And second, do some of these models with Gore and Morningstar scale downwards when you have 50 employees in a startup or 100 employees? And how does it translate? Because they're pretty flat to begin with.
So great couple of questions. Let me try to tackle that. Yes, there are differences around the world. You know, if you look at different cultures put more of an emphasis on collectivism versus individualism, or they have more respect for authority, hierarchy, experience than you find in other cultures. Having said that, some of the most interesting management experiments in the world are taking place in cultures that seem to be more hierarchical and more traditional. I talked about this company in China, Haier, H-A-I-E-R, Haier, which is, has an amazingly decentralized, flat management model with leaders kind of chosen from below. That doesn't happen yet in China as a country, but it happens within organizations in China. I think of HCL Technologies in India, where they have had a conscious effort to invert the pyramid. One example today in that company, every employee has the right to evaluate their leader, their leader's leader. All those evaluations go up online, so there's no place for a tyrant to hide. So I don't think it's limited to any particular culture. In fact, what I think is happening, if you think about this next generation that's coming to work, this is the first generation, for as far back as we know, it's the first generation whose primary social reference point is not a traditional hierarchy. They grew up on the web. And on the web, you just start with a different set of assumptions, that every idea should compete on an equal footing, that every leader should be somebody who's actually worth following, and if not, ignore them, that what should really matter is your contribution, not your credentials. And so around the world, that next generation, they are all growing up with that similar experience on the web. And you see how that is disrupting power structures all over the world, political power structures, corporate power structures. That genie is not going to go back in the bottle. And it's one of the things that makes me very optimistic. About scaling it down, yeah, you can take this set of principles in an organization of whatever size. You know, I used to run a small consulting company, and even though I was a CEO, we had a completely 360-degree compensation system, all peer-based. So at whatever your size, you can start with that set of principles and work from there.
Thank you.
John Brigginshaw, Gary, hello. Just taking up on that 360-degree compensation point, you said it helps people develop into entrepreneurs, but is there a danger that it might just make people turn into politicians?
You know, if you separate those individuals from a real scorecard, yeah, there's that risk. But if you all know that what really matters in the end is you gotta produce profit, or you gotta satisfy customers, or meet the needs of your constituents. If you have that external scorecard, which can't be gamed, which is there, which gives you feedback, then there's less of that risk. Without this, yes, it can turn into kind of a politicized system where people form cliques. But if you have that external benchmark, so let me give you an example. At Gore, most of the associates there, their biggest financial asset is shares they hold in Gore. So, you know, I could, you know, if you're my friend, I could maybe bump you up in the ranking. But at the end of the day, I'm looking forward to my retirement. I want a company that's really delivering. So that economic incentive, if I have the right scorecard, the right incentives, is going to outweigh whatever political incentive I might have. But it's a good question, something you have to be very vigilant about.
Hello, my name is Matt Kukuk. I work for a large technology company that operates actually on some of the same principles that they're talking about here. And your examples today have been about bureaucracy and hierarchy within private companies, which is very fair because they do struggle with that, with the issues they talked about. But at the same time, in the private industry, there's an incentive to change if there is a better way, so you get a hearing if you talk about a better way to do things. What about the situation with government bureaucracy, which in many ways is a larger and more rigid system?
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. That in the private sector, you do have an ultimate arbiter called the customer. And that customer will take their business away, or you go bankrupt. But there are things in the private sector, stupidity doesn't last forever, right? At some point, you know, the market exerts itself. That's not always true inside of government bureaucracies. And so I think the challenge there goes back to what I was saying a moment ago. The challenge is creating scorecards that measure effectiveness in the services that are delivered to those end customers, and they are customers, they are paying through their taxes, but it's making sure that that scoreboard is paramount, that everyone in that organization can see how they're doing against that and are held accountable for it. So I don't think the problem is different in kind, but, you know, you have to have a different scoreboard because you don't have the one of market share, P&L, and so on, but you can invent other ones. And some of the most progressive government bureaucracies around the world, in Singapore, other places, they're moving in this direction. All right. Well, thank you so much. I'm going to hand it back over.
Good evening. My name is Edouard Josin. I don't want to tell my title anymore after this presentation, but I can only say I was part of the team that Jillian led to co-organize this event today. And we want to thank a few people who helped us organize this event as well. So first of all, thank you so much, Gary, again, for your time today being with us. I think this was a very insightful presentation. Second, we want to thank Kevin O'Malley. Maybe you want to stand up again, and the Commonwealth Club of San Francisco for hosting us in this amazing location. Third, we want to thank Stevie Park and Paul Constantino. Paul, maybe you want to stand up here. They belong to an organization called First Tuesday, and they were great mentors for us in order to make this event happen tonight. Last but not least, I want to thank again Jillian Gray. I think if there is one person in the last couple of weeks who showed us how empowering people can make things happen in a couple of weeks, Jillian is a great example of it. So thank you also to all of you for being here tonight, and we hope to see you again very soon. Thank you very much.
I'd like to thank our audience here today at the Commonwealth Club and our audience listening at home. Our program today has been The End of Hierarchy with Gary Hamill. I'm Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum. Thank you for all being here tonight. And with this, I'd like to close this program of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened public discussion.